This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It was a time when shopping at Goodwill was a fashion don't. Secondhand clothes were considered unsanitary and a sign of poverty. The hippie movement changed some of those attitudes. That movement was at least superficially anti-capitalist and anti-establishment, so old clothes were part of the aesthetic. And by the 1990s, the grunge movement created a whole generation of secondhand shoppers. Today, there are trendy stores dedicated to old T-shirts and mom jeans. Joining us from our partner station WHQR in Wilmington is Jennifer Lazat. She's a professor of history and material culture at UNC Wilmington and author of From Goodwill to Grunge, A History of Secondhand Styles and Alternative Economies. Hello, Jennifer. Welcome to State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Thanks.
In the beginning of your book, you start with a story that I think vividly illustrates the way people once viewed secondhand clothes. Can you tell it to us?
Sure. Well, it's a young girl wants to go to a dance and she wants a new dress, but her family budget does not allow for this. And she decides to buy one secondhand from, as the story quotes, the Jewess behind the counter. So there is an affiliation also with Jewish salespeople with secondhand, and anti-Semitism plays a role in the disregard for it. So she buys a dress and she goes to this spring fling. And she is not only called out on her subterfuge, right? Somebody says, "What are you doing wearing Emily's dress?" But upon going home, she learns that all of the clothing at this secondhand store had had a communicable disease, yellow fever, and this was a common trope in these stories. And it not only made her a social pariah, but it sickened her whole family and disfigured her for life. So the ramifications of buying secondhand and being a status dissembler were clear in the 1880s.
So this is 1880, and this is a news story and not an uncommon news story. Tell us about the role that anti-Semitism played in all of this and why that would be any part of the fear of secondhand clothes in the 19th century.
Absolutely. Well, in Europe, as well as in the United States, the Jewish diaspora, members of the Jewish diaspora, were frequently kept from having a lot of professionalized jobs. So it became a common fallback to trade in secondhand clothing, particularly. So when Jewish populations began to arrive in the United States in higher numbers in the 1880s and after, they took on that mantle as well. Pawn shops, push cart sales of new and used goods were commonly associated with Jewish populations. And so anti-Semitism meant that this was just one more reason, along with unsanitary clothing and false status seeking, that proper native-born Americans would not seek out secondhand sales.
And how much of this, I mean, we sort of take it for granted on the one hand. I mean, if you're not talking about secondhand chic and sort of shopping to look cool, I mean, if there's an idea that you shouldn't shop secondhand, it's because it makes you look somehow poor. You're sort of a little down at the heel, and that proves it. But I guess we shouldn't take this for granted either, because certainly mm-hmm. there was a time before this, say before the 19th, in the 18th century, when the fact is that's what people did. They were very conservative with her. And the idea that you would hand things down and perhaps buy secondhand may not have been quite the stigma that it may have become since. Would that be correct?
It is. It is. And in some ways, especially buying, but also there wasn't as much secondhand material available until mass production. So in the 18th and throughout much of the 19th century, you would maybe inherit some fine fabrics from a family member or something, or buy it at an auction even. But clothing kind of changed in status in the 19th, early 20th century with mass production of clothing and became a little bit more disposable while still being usable. So a lot of factors played into this. For instance, the popular acceptance of germ theory, whereupon people came to realize that germs would hitchhike on particularly cloth items. So practices of reuse within middle class families or middling class families at the time where, if your husband's shirt fell apart, you would remake that into a pinafore for your daughter. If that became too dirty, you'd stuff furniture with it. Well, people began to think of this as being not proper care of your family. So discarding clothing that still had some use came into the back exact same time as greater accessibility of new clothing because of mass production
right.
and distribution.
And mass production and distribution, of course, went hand in hand with public relations that convinced you that you must have the newest and the best. So they did everything possible to promote this stuff because now they're making it. And if they don't have a buyer, they go out of business. Right? It's part of the
absolutely. Yeah. Advertising plays in always.
So by the 1920s, Goodwill and Salvation Army are actually profitable businesses. What's happened here between 1880 and in the 1920s?
Well, speaking of advertising, part of that had to do with the Salvation Army, particularly, but Goodwill Industries also benefited from the fact that, first of all, they were a Christian-affiliated organization, and so they didn't have the stigma that anti-Semitism imparted to pawn shops and other push cart facilities selling secondhand. So they had that, and they also would just distribute flyers talking about how they had these huge industrial washing machines that would scrub these things clean. So that made it more palatable for consumers, but they also made it more appropriate for donors by using kind of popular ideas of against direct giving, right? So instead of charity, whereupon you just give something to somebody, Salvation Army and Goodwill also gave indigent or impoverished populations a place to work so they could, you know, earn their keep and be included in them along the ranks of the deserving poor. So it wasn't direct giving charity. I call it philanthropic capitalism. So that's really central. This idea of a thrift store is embracing this sustaining idea of thrift in America while also disseminating ideas of mass consumerism and consumption and saying everybody can join in on this and we're helping uplift through this. So it was a very keen contemporary notion of philanthropy.
And in terms of the consumers and the people who were going there to buy these clothes, the everybody included that increasingly large number of immigrants who wanted to assimilate and look like Americans, right?
Yes. And that was a target audience, though, you know, immigrants always expressed ambivalence about that for a number of reasons and perhaps did not embrace the ideas to the extent that Salvation Army and Goodwill and other such philanthropic organizations expected or wished. And from the beginning, there were native-born or young populations of consumers who were shopping secondhand recreationally.
I'm talking today to Jennifer Lazat, who teaches at UNC Wilmington. Her new book is From Goodwill to Grunge, A History of Secondhand Styles and Alternative Economies. And we talked about the rise of Goodwill and Salvation Army in the 1920s. And then, of course, there was the rise of the garage. The fact is that people began collecting more junk because the houses started getting bigger. Talk about suburbanization and that impact.
Yeah, so the garage sale is really the most American innovation of secondhand sales venues that I can think of. And it's coupled with suburbanization. You know, in the decade following World War II, 11 million new houses are built in outside of cities. Goodwill and Salvation Army don't quite catch up as quickly as they might in having facilities where housewives mostly can donate clothing and other goods they don't need so much. Garage sales developed as a suburban housewife innovation, a way to, once you had a garage or an attic full of stuff, which for the first time people could accumulate enough to have a single family sale, or sometimes they would do it through their churches or neighborhoods. But they would use this to sort of, in some ways, work around or accommodate gender constrictions of the time, whereupon a housewife could join the supposed breadwinner in the family in earning some money, right? So that without giving up their domestic reign. And also participate in politics. A lot of garage sales in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s were fundraisers for various political organizations or candidates, as well as religious organizations. So it was a way for housewives to join in society in ways they might not have been able to being isolated in suburbia.
And we're also beginning to see a turn in who is buying, who is, you know, the consumers in the secondhand market, because it's not just people who, you know, need this and are being thrifty because they need to. It becomes a thing to do, right? Going to garage sales.
Absolutely. So in some ways, the popularity of garage the lie to the sort of popular expectation that suburbanites were all conformers, right? They all wanted to buy and keep up with the Joneses and look like each other. When actually they did express the desire for creativity and originality in their decor and personal comportment. And garage sales facilitated that for some of them. So certainly, especially of younger generations, this was how they were exposed to even different cultural means of appearing and presenting oneself.
And then the 60s, the hippie movie, which really, I mean, and of course, if we look back into the Beat Generation, the Beats, too, were looking to create a counterculture, kind of anti-capitalist market. And so
Absolutely.
It actually starts back there and then moves into the hippie movement. So tell us about the impact of those two ideas.
Well, I look at the 50s and 60s as having kind of two veins of mass popularization of secondhand. The one is elective poverty, and that comes from the Beats, and it rises out of a popular notion that there are way more poor than we can really see, than are visible, and the beginning of some sort of social awareness among middle-class bred Americans that makes them want to represent affinity with marginalized groups. And the Beats definitely reflect this most clearly. Jack Kerouac definitely talks about this all the time, and other poets talk about goodwill directly and romanticize dressing poor. On the other hand, there is vintage dress, which is also an avoidance of looking middle class, but it is more of an embrace of elitism, right? So the very first time that the word vintage is applied to clothing popularly was when there was this craze in 1956 and 57 for raccoon coats from the 1920s. And they were sold at Lord & Taylor and major department stores. And it was basically bought by a lot of college Ivy League students. And they were expressing an affinity with the wealthy generation from the 1920s. And you can almost see how they would wear these heavy raccoon fur coats to, you know, Great Gatsby-themed parties and things like that. So they're trying to avoid looking middle class by going in the other direction, while the Beats and later hippies are trying to disregard the middle class by embracing the affects of the marginalized.
And so all of these trends are building an ever larger market for reused clothes. And what capitalism mm-hmm. loves best is an anti-capitalist movement with a lot of buyers. And so
Precisely.
Won't you know, they come right in and decide to make expensive, cheap clothes.
Absolutely. It wasn't long before secondhand vintage and what became known as retro combine and become sort of muddy the waters. So retro, to many clothing aficionados, fashion historians, refers to a vintage look, right? But it's also often mass-produced clothing. So Urban Outfitters is the prime example of this, which was a company that started as Free People's Clothing, and it was secondhand. And it was started in 1970, definitely piggybacking on some of the major ways of distributing free and used clothing in the hippie movement and the counterculture, so-called counterculture movement. But Dick Hayne sort of moved the proprietor of Free People's, expanded, and eventually Urban Outfitters changed the name to Urban Outfitters, and they started offering just one secondhand section and actually making retro new clothing and as it ever has been.
Well, and then of course the grunge movement, which I mean, do you see that as you know, sort of in the genealogy from the Beats to the hippies to the grunge, or is that a categorically different kind of a movement?
Oh, no, it is referencing 100%, 100 years of gender disruption that secondhand is responsible for. There's a chapter I have about that, the title of which I can't say, but on radio. But gender disruption and sympathy for the marginalized, as well as vintage exhibitionism. But what grunge is doing that's new is they're being very ironic and sardonic about it. They don't really believe, like some of the diggers did in the 1960s, that they can change the world by wearing old clothes, right? So there's a heavy, heavy dose of irony in their expressions. But it's sometimes done in a pretty sophisticated way and incorporating some of the other relevant meanings of secondhand clothing since the 19th century.
And how does and the fact is again the makers can clothing makers fashion designers do capitalize on this. So the fact is that looking like it's been stored for a long time in somebody's garage is now very popular. Does it remain so? Has it been sort of on a scale in increasing popularity, or does it wax and wane over time?
It certainly waxes and wanes, but I do feel like contemporarily there's major factor that needs to be addressed, and that's that of fast fashion. The fact that the fashion industry is on hyperspeed, right? So you, because of outsourcing, because of the rapidity of manufacturing, distribution, and the rapidly changing ideas of fashion, nothing sticks around for very long. And people buy so many more clothes. Clothes are cheap now because of many of these factors. So why buy secondhand if you just want a new outfit, if you can get the same thing at Forever 21 for $4.99 and throw it away in 2 weeks because clothing has become disposable like that. But there's also a reaction against that at the same time, slow fashion. And this is causing some people to embrace buying good vintage old clothing in greater numbers as well. So it's gotten much more complicated. The reasons, the rationales, there's still environmentalism in all of these. But the sheer tonnage of clothing that Americans discard and become the property of developing or the global southern countries, Africa, for example, is to the extent that it can't be looked on as charitable.
There you
anymore.
Go. You just do what I do and just wear the same clothes you've been wearing for the past 40 years. And it's like the watch that's broken. It's right twice a year. So twice
exactly.
a day. And that's the way. That's the way
twice a decade.
Twice a decade, I guess, is the way it's going. And the fact is that it's not just making clothes that look used. There are actual whole stores that now are trading in at a very high level actual used clothes, right? Consignment clothing.
Oh, absolutely. The, you know, specialization of secondhand has grown. So, you won't anymore at Goodwill or Salvation Army find a Coco Chanel that snuck by. They know. And they're looking for those things and distributing them to the right target audience. So you have consignment, you have high-end vintage, you have every category of clothing that you possibly can in secondhand as well as firsthand.
And you say this is a quintessentially or maybe uniquely American feature and phenomenon. Why so? Is this not happening everywhere else?
No, I don't think it's uniquely American at all. In fact, you know, flea markets, marché aux puces, were originated in France. So, and Great Britain has car boot sales, which are their versions of garage sales.
It's a smaller country. They don't have whole garages. It's just the trunk of your car. But you get the idea, yeah.
And they started – there's a legal reason, actually, because they started to develop garage sales later, and there were laws prohibiting sales like that. So they – did car boot sales instead. But in America, I think because consumption has been such a hyper-focus, and there's been such a great turnover of fashion and clothing that it's maybe been embraced more quickly, greater and earlier than in other nations. But it's not unique. Garage sales are a unique venue for them, but it definitely shares a lot of factors globally with other.
And the great thing about this is if I ask you what's next in the secondhand clothing, you can look backward and not forward. It's kind of cool.
That's true. I think more of the same, but in different ways. So activism associated with it will remain, but I think that it will tend towards ethical clothing movement where there's attention given to workers' rights globally, and it's taken on a much more global visage for those who are aware of why they're buying secondhand and don't just want to look different, which is still a motivating factor.
Yeah, they could bring attention to why clothes are, in quotes, cheap because they cost somebody a whole lot. So that's very, very cool stuff. Great treatment, great study. Jennifer Lazat, the author of From Goodwill to Grunge, A History of Secondhand Styles and Alternative Economies, a professor of history and material culture at UNC Wilmington. Jennifer Lazat, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Frank. It was fun.
She joined us from our Wilmington partner station, WHQR, and you can find out more about her book at our website, stateofthings.org. Well, we go from secondhand clothes to the elaborate regal fashion of the Catholic Church. We'll talk about a current Met exhibit that focuses on fashions inspired by the Church. Stay tuned.